7:41 on the Mighty 690. James Copeland with you on this Wednesday. And since it is Wednesday, it means it's time for an update from K-State Research and Extension. We have a Dave in joining us from the Wildcat District. How are you doing this morning?
Doing good, thank you. Yeah. How are you?
Pretty good. Good to see you. Your Wednesday off and rolling?
Yeah, get it started bright and early.
Good deal. Excellent one. There's nothing like being on the radio first thing in the morning. So we're going to talk some... first of all, I wanted to ask you how the event went this past weekend.
Yeah, it went really good. We had a turnout of about 270 people, and I believe we had somewhere between a dozen and two dozen vendors and a lot of different demonstrations going on. So it was a great event, especially for our first year. We're very happy with how it turned out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's very good. So you're talking coyotes this morning.
Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about coyotes. They are the number one predator of livestock in Kansas and in most of the western United States. So in general, coyotes will range in areas of about 10 to 25 square miles, and those ranges usually overlap to varying degrees, kind of depending on how many coyotes there are in an area. Usually they travel in small groups of about three coyotes, and coyotes in Kansas, and really coyotes everywhere, are accustomed to human odor. So they're not very afraid of people or just the smell of people. They do like to keep their distance, but they're very adaptable. So they've adapted to people over the years. Even with this, they are active mostly at night, but they sometimes do venture close to houses, even in the daylight, if they have enough cover where they can feel like they're kind of concealed and hidden, not seen very well. So in Kansas, coyotes usually go through or under fences whenever possible as they're traveling around, and also unfortunately to get to livestock and chickens as one of their food sources. However, they are capable of also jumping or climbing over fences, and will do so if they needed. And of course, not all coyotes kill livestock. The coyotes that are killing livestock are usually referred to as offending animals, kind of. They're the offender. It's their fault. So it is desirable when using lethal methods of control to direct those methods at the offending animals. And this can be kind of tricky because, of course, there's not a way to just look at a coyote and know if it's the offender, if it's the one that's been killing your chickens or your sheep and goats. However, in a damaged situation, so a situation where a coyote has killed some chickens or kids, which are young goats, control methods can be concentrated in and around the damaged area. And if you're able to track the coyote along those travel routes to and from the area. So when it's done this way, there's reasonable assurance that the offending coyote or coyotes will be among the first few coyotes that are captured or trapped. And research has found that time after time, when they have worked with producers experiencing coyote problems, who after capturing one or a few coyotes had no more predator problems for months, or in some cases even years afterwards, despite the continued presence of coyotes in their area, because they did take care of the ones that were causing the problem. And predation on livestock appears to bear some relationship, of course, to coyotes' seasonal energy needs, which are their nutritional needs, which vary throughout the year. For example, females that are raising a litter of pups will have increased nutritional needs. And then, of course, when those pups are growing and learning to hunt, they'll have increased nutritional needs as well. And this also is kind of related to the abundance of other food sources in the area, such as other wildlife, like rabbits, squirrels, other small animals. And coyotes, like I mentioned before, they are very adaptable, and not just in the sense of getting used to people and being able to live in different areas, but also in their food sources. So it's common for them to eat smaller animals, chickens, lambs, kids, but also they've been found to eat fruit out of orchards, vegetables out of gardens, that sort of thing as well. So for the life cycle of coyotes, coyotes breed in February and have one litter of usually about 5 to 7 pups in late April or early May. And during and immediately after, when they have their pups, as I mentioned before, their energy demands increase rapidly as the parents provide food for these pups. And at this time, it's common for producers to have problems with coyotes killing their livestock because they are an easily available source of food. Coyotes are also pretty opportunistic. And then in late summer and early fall, so the time period we're in right now, another increase in coyote predation is usually noted. And that's because at this time of year, the food demands are for the pups that have gotten bigger and are fast growing. And it's also the time of year when those pups are starting to go out and hunt on their own and look for kind of more natural food. So they're getting weaned, they're having to learn how to hunt. And then again, domestic livestock, animals, even sometimes cats and small dogs can offer an easily obtained source of food. And this late summer increase in predation may also be related to, again, the coyotes learning to hunt, and then winter loss of livestock to coyotes are generally decreased than other times throughout the year because they will have an energy need to stay warm throughout the winter, but it's not as great because those pups are a little bit older, they figured out to hunt. And the females in early winter haven't had the pups yet, so they're not raising them. So that is just a little bit about coyotes and why producers may be having some problems with them. And there's also been some studies that have come out in the last couple of years that I've thought have been interesting, because there's actually a pack of coyotes in Chicago that there's a researcher there that has been following them and has tracking collars on them, and they've found that the coyotes have figured out how to use the crosswalks at the stoplights. So I thought that was pretty
urban
interesting.
Coyotes, yeah. What on earth? Oh my goodness. And you know, being out in the country and everything, it always sounds, you said they're packs of, you know, three or four. It always sounds like there's about 30, you know, at night. It's wild.
Yeah, no, and I've been hearing the pups the last couple nights or early mornings around my house. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because Drew Ricketts, who will be coming down beginning of November to do a workshop on coyotes, I think it was 2 years ago now, I was at a workshop he gave on coyotes, and he did a lot of, I believe his grad school work for his master's or doctorate was a study on coyotes, and he had a video that was two coyotes that were captured in, so they were in kennels, and it was a video of them at night howling, and if you just heard it and didn't see, you would have thought that it was, you know, a dozen or so coyotes, and it was just the two of them talking back and forth.
They can be very noisy.
Yes, they can.
So are there any, you know, if someone has an actual coyote problem, you know, they're getting chickens, that sort of thing, are there any trapping methods that are successful?
Yeah. So the foothold style of traps is usually the recommended trapping style for coyotes. And when Drew Ricketts comes down in November, he's going to talk about how to go about controlling coyotes, different trapping methods to do it as humanely as possible for the coyotes, mm-hmm. and how to set those traps, how to figure out placing those traps, considerations on placing the traps on if you have dogs around yourself, which of course you don't sure. want them getting into those traps. So there are different control options available depending on where you're at, kind of what your setup is.
Yeah, because I was just at the Wilson County Old Iron Days, and they had a whole exhibit there on, you know, trapping. And, you know, they had all these antique traps. You know, we think of all those kind of bear traps and everything, uh-huh. but they were like, you know, what we use today is a lot more modern than, you know, they had all those antique ones up there, but they're like, you know, we have kept with the times too, as far as trappers trying to do things as humanely as possible. Because, you know, that guy I was talking to is like, look, I have dogs. I would, you know, I don't want, you know, even those, these are, you know, pets. I don't want them to suffer. You know, you wouldn't want to be as humane. And two, I believe the season is year round on, you know, like hunting and that sort of thing.
Yes. Well. So for coyotes, it is year round. So a couple years ago, they came out with a new law about using night vision to hunt coyotes. So that to do that, that does have a season. But when it comes to protecting your livestock, you're able to do that year round. It's a little bit different if someone was wanting to just go out and trap and they weren't having any problems with coyotes getting their livestock.
Sure.
But yeah, when coyotes are harming your livestock, then you can take measures to control that year round.
Gotcha. All right, David, you said you have some upcoming programs coming
up,
right?
Yeah, so the first one I wanted to talk about is they are doing a broom sedge field trial news update. So Wendy, this is a big project that Wendy's doing in partnership with the Conservation District. And Dr. Pedrera Bruno, he's one of the researchers at the Southeast Center. They're in Parsons, and so they've been doing this study in all four counties on fertilization rates on broom sedge, which is very problematic for producers because it gets into pastures and it can be pretty invasive. It's also referred to as poverty grass. So they're doing an update on what they found so far in this trial, and they'll be doing one in Fredonia at the Old Iron Club on October 8th. From 11 to 2, and lunch is provided. And they do ask that you RSVP for that by September 30th so they can get a head count for the meal. And you can do that by calling 620-378-2866. And she will also be doing a trial update as well in Caney at that location. And I don't have that date in front of me, but I believe that one is on October 22nd. But if you call our Independence office at 620-331-2690, I can double check that date for you. And lunch is also provided at that update as well. And then, as I mentioned, the beginning of November, Drew Ricketts, who is the wildlife specialist at K-State, will be coming down on November 3rd that evening to talk about coyotes, and then also how to trap them, how to call them, different control methods. It's a really interesting workshop. Even if you're not interested in learning the different control methods, you can learn a lot of interesting information about just coyotes and how they operate. And that will be November 3rd at 6:30 at the Research Center in Parsons. And it's free to attend, and dinner will be provided.
All right. Good deal. Anything else to wrap up? I know we're going to have James Coover coming in on the phone here in the next segment, but we got about a minute here. Anything else?
No, that's about all I had to talk about this morning. Still have been getting some questions about blue-green algae.
Sure.
Since it heated back up last week. Yeah. So for those folks out there who have ponds, just continue to be aware of that. We're not out of the woods on dealing with that yet. Unfortunately. So that's all I have this morning.
Okay, good deal. Well, we'll come back here in just a few after the news and be chatting with James Coover here on the Mighty 690 as we continue our conversation with folks from K-State Research and Extension. Fox News on the way. We're going to have a high today in the mid-80s for southeast Kansas and northeast Oklahoma, going down to the upper 40s, low 50s tonight, and then back up into the mid to lower 80s tomorrow. Currently 58 in Coffeyville.
Part of the year in the middle of winter. So, you know, soybean fields, they actually held in a little bit better than I expected. But they were green, but there wasn't a whole lot there. And so, you know, many of them are going to be less than 10 bushels to the acre. And it's already set that that's probably what they're going to be if they get harvested at all, honestly. And so, you know, they're drying down now, but we're about to get into that. So wheat planting, it's not quite time yet. Unless we get some rain, there really won't be a whole lot of wheat planting because we have to have some sort of moisture to get that germination, and we don't want to risk putting in all that wheat seed, having a really light rain, and having germination then getting it killed. So, wheat planting, it might just be delayed again this year, or it might not even happen, honestly, in some areas. So another major issue right now, though, is the complete lack of grass for our cattle operations. Fescue, it's not even trying to green up. I mean, maybe there's some in people's yards and down, but, like, out in the field, there's no fescue out there even attempting it. The Bermuda, it's there and it's green, but it's not really growing. I mean, Bermuda will just kind of hold on to its green color, but there's really nothing there. I mean, cattle have grubbed it down already, so there's nothing there to eat. Even the native grasses that are pretty drought-resistant, I mean, they're not really greening up either. And so it's because there's no moisture down there for them to get a hold of. And so they're just hanging in there and not doing anything. So, you know, everything right now is just turning into cattle forage. I mean, we're talking the first field, corn crop. I mean, we turned it into silage. I mean, field corn turned into silage. Corn stock failed for the fields that we did harvest. And then some soybean fields even were baled green, which is not something we normally do. I mean, we never bale our soybeans, but this year, some fields was just worth the bale instead. So now I see really there's only one thing left. I mean, it's pretty much a fire sale of every forage that we have. The only thing left I see is the stover after the soybean harvest. This will be, for the most part, our fields are all been double cropped. And so there's wheat stubble, and there'll be corn stubble mixed in, and turning that stuff into bale. It won't be a whole lot of baleage because there's not a lot of matter there, and the quality of it without processing it or doing something to it is incredibly low just because it's mostly carbon, and, I mean, it's not very good forage. But that brings up today's topic, which is ammoniation of poor quality forage.
Okay, and so you said that word. I wanted to, can you describe what is ammoniation? I assume that it has something to do with ammonia, perhaps?
Yes, yeah. And so, you know, ammoniation is basically the aspect of putting ammonia, basically anhydrous ammonia, into a bale. And that seems odd because we're putting a fertilizer into a bale, like a gas. And that's really what we're doing. And so the ammonia hydrous, we create a giant chamber pretty much, and we gas these bales with ammonia, and it converts. And so the ammonia will react with water and form ammonia hydroxide. And this is a really powerful alkaline compound that will break down the cellulose and the lignin in the bale to some degree. And this also improves the protein, mostly from the ammonia itself can actually act as a protein, but also it improves the digestibility and the palatability of really low-quality forages. And so it's basically, it forms such a strong alkaline compound that it breaks down the lignin and breaks down the cellulose within that bale. And so it should be noted, though, this is only to make really low-quality forages slightly better. You cannot do this with everything. I mean, if you have basically anything with a very low sugar content in that bale, which is most of our stovers after we've harvested something, have very low sugar content. Anything with a higher sugar content, like basically like corn or soybeans that were baled before harvest, basically they were baled green, all those are going to have way too much sugar in them. And then when you ammoniate them, they'll actually form a toxic compound because the ammonia will attach to those sugars and create a sort of toxic compound that cows are very sensitive to.
Yeah. So you know, when you're talking about this, I'm thinking of, you know, wow, this sounds pretty space-agey, kind of like where the picture that comes into my mind, which I'm sure is incorrect, is like bales going on an assembly line and like getting squirted with, you know, gas or something. So, but can you explain, I'm sure that's not realistic, so can you explain the actual process of how bales are ammoniated?
Yeah, it's not entirely inaccurate, but so, you know, really what we do is, there's a bunch of different ways. The most common way, though, is basically doing a pyramid. And so the bales are stacked on a pyramid, and there's in a big pyramid, so maybe, you know, three tall, and they'll have a perforated pipe underneath them all, and so stacked on top of a perforated pipe. Then that pyramid is covered up in a sheet of plastic, and the edges are covered with some sort of dirt or gravel. So you've really made just a giant balloon with the bales inside of it. Then ammonia gas is gassed into that chamber and then sealed. And so that then the conversion process, it takes around 2 weeks to 2 months, depending on the temperature. And so, you know, as we get into the colder months, it's going to take a little bit longer for the ammoniization process to happen. And then they need to be basically uncovered and let that some of that, those gases released before they can be fed. So if farmers are interested in it, they can't wait too long after soybean harvest because there's a time process here. And so, you know, there's other ways of ammoniating these bales, basically doing individual bales one at a time. That's a lot harder to control, but it is possible. And so if you have the baleage capability, but instead of silaging it, we're going to ammoniate it. So that is also possible. But there's a lot of good diagram publications, YouTube channels. I mean, there's a lot of stuff online that you can find to show you how this can be done. And it's a lot easier to see what other people are working with.
Sure, and I was almost wondering, is there like a kit you send away for? Or, you know, because you obviously have to get those, you know, ammonia and all that stuff.
No, for the most part, I mean, farmers, they're going to need to buy that big sheet of plastic.
Okay.
Usually it's like 100 by 40 and 6 mil thick. Everything else, farmers, you know, they have a lot of stuff lying around.
Oh yeah.
And they're gonna farmer rig everything out.
Oh yeah.
So they find a way for the rest of it and try to make it as cheap as possible. So, you know, one part is how much ammonia we need for this, because that's the expensive thing. Fertilizer ammonia, anhydrous ammonia, it's not cheap. So, you know, we're talking about 1.5 to 3% ammonia to dry matter on the bale, and that's how much we regulate the ammonia by. How much dry matter we actually need to convert, even though the moisture in it will be variable, and so that's around 60 pounds of ammonia per dry matter ton at 3%. And so, I mean, 60 pounds of ammonia—that's so, you know. But besides that, of course, when you're doing, no matter what method you're doing, you got to be careful with ammonia. It's really dangerous to work with. This stuff, I mean, it basically sucks the moisture out of everything it touches. And so your skin, if you breathe it in, it basically burns you, really. And so any farmer working with that kind of stuff, you know, wear protective equipment, follow safety guidelines. This is not stuff to mess around with. So.
Yeah, I mean, even household ammonia. We know we want to be there's safety precautions involved with that. So
exactly.
So what is, I guess, the whole point of this? You know, what is the overall improvement to bales when you're doing this?
So, you know, the crude protein and that digestibility is actually improved, and also the palatability of it as well. And so, for instance, this is, you know, crude protein, and so that's the difference between crude protein and digestible protein. But in wheat straw, the crude protein is around 3.5% before it's ammoniated, and it's 9.5% after ammonization. And so, I mean, and then corn stover, it's probably, you know, 4% before ammoniation, and it could be up to 10% after ammoniation. And so it's a pretty considerable jump in protein, at least in crude protein. And the same thing with digestibility, too, because a lot of those lignans are getting broken down, the cellulose is getting broken down, so the digestibility of it is increasing. I mean, wheat straw, we're talking about 40% before and then about 50% after. And that 10% might not seem like a lot, but it's a considerable increase when we're talking about how much overall forage is actually able to be digested by the animal. And so, and the same thing with corn stover, it's around a 10% to 15% of that that lignin, basically, or whatever it is that's breaking down, is able to be digested afterwards. So, and another part to it is, you know, when cows are really hungry, they'll eat pretty much, you know, a lot of different stuff. But ammoniation actually improves palatability as well. And so they're more likely to eat this stuff, or they won't reject it as much, I guess. I mean, in the middle of winter, they'll eat just about anything, but they will prefer to eat this stuff after it's ammoniated anyway. And so that kind of helps the aspect of it as well.
All right. Well, anything else you'd like to add on this topic?
You know, and so part of the thing is the cost of all of this, and that's the real big question. I mean, it's always the question: what is the cost? And also, let's just say that not all the ammonia protein, because we were talking about crude protein and digestible protein, so not all that protein advantage is digestible, because the ammonia is actually acting as a protein. It's kind of odd that cows can process ammonia and turn it into protein, but it's something that they can do. It's part of the reason why we can actually feed urea to cows and get them to make that into protein. So not all that ammonia is a protein, but still we can, you know, the crude protein is improved. So the cost, though. And so when we're talking about cost, The ammoniation rate changes the cost quite a bit. And so if we're talking about 30 pounds of ammonia per dry matter ton, we're talking about $21 or $42 if we're talking about 60 pounds of ammonia. And so I was just kind of looking at, you know, what the local anhydrous ammonia prices are. And, you know, that's quite a bit. But then we're also talking about the cost of the pipe, of the plastic, of the diesel, of stacking all this. You know, and even if the farmer's time is free, you know, the dry matter ton is probably around $12 to $13. So you put that all together, and we're talking about $33 to $54 per dry matter ton. And so per bale, that's probably around, I mean, you know, $25 per bale. And then the baling cost of all that is another $25. And so, I mean, straw bales are pretty light, and of course we're mixing in soybean stover as well. And so, you know, that soybean stover, it's been sitting there in the field for a year. Normally it's broken down by now, but this year, you know, it hasn't rained, so it's still saving there. So we mix that soybean stover and that corn wheat stover together, and it's not going to make the best stuff. But the ammoniation, it's not cheap, but it has at least something that you can add to those bales. It does take some time, obviously. It does take some work to get that stuff. But it's kind of, at this point, the last resort that I can think of to get at least a little more forage out there if we don't get some rain. Because we got a lot of fields around here that are double crop soybeans that aren't looking very good, but at least it's something out there. So So what else can we give our cattle? And this isn't the best thing. This is why we don't normally do it most years, but it is at least something else that's possible.
Sure, there are really, you know, not a lot of low-hanging options right now, but I appreciate you sharing that because, you know, you're kind of pulling all the stops out, all the tricks in our proverbial hat there on all
exactly.
this. So if folks have questions on any of this, how can they find you guys?
Yeah, so give us a call, anyone in the extension offices. The number for Girard is 620-724-8233.
All righty. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us. Davin, thank you. It's good to have you on again. And we will chat with more folks from K-State Research and Extension next week at this time. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.